Thinking as I was traveling to New York, because we hadn't actually announced the topic, or I wasn't aware of what the topic was going to be. But what I was struggling with was the idea that, looking back at my own life, personally, I've been always interested in the abstract, in the metaphysical, in these great journeys into the infinite and the unbounded and the eternal, and trying to figure it out intellectually. And about less than a year ago, I don't know the exact date, I was at the Royal Albert Hall in England and happened to have a very wonderful a private meeting with His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and we got into some abstract discussions, because that's where I always direct people, even the Dalai Lama. And he stopped me in the middle of it and he said, it's interesting, and one can go on into abstractions forever, but how does it change our life? And how does knowing what you are trying to express right now, how does it change people's lives? And I realized that His Holiness, even though he can, if he wants to, take the same journeys, if even into a more extended domain of awareness, that he's a very practical man. And ultimately, what really matters is the essence of Buddhism is the alleviation of suffering. Even the Buddha himself was not really interested in the abstractions of reincarnation theories or the different realms of being, even though Tibetan Buddhism is the authority in all those areas. The Buddha himself was only interested in one question. And what is the cause of human suffering, and what is the way out of it? That's the essence of Buddhism, basically. And so I'm not going to steal the thunder from Bob, who's the expert in this area, but I'd like to start off with just that one question from a Vedantic perspective.
Please.
And then perhaps what we can do is draw the parallels between Vedanta and Buddhism, if that's all right. Because essentially, you know, it's a question of semantics,
sure.
I think.
Mm-hmm.
So Vedanta, which is the great wisdom tradition of India that goes back at least 1500 BC, and the authors of the Vedanta are the great rishis who span several eras of time, especially the ones who wrote the Upanishads. If I could summarize what Vedanta says about the subject, and in fact, if I could summarize the whole of Vedanta in the next 10 minutes, it would be as follows. It would be as follows. Vedanta says that there are five reasons why human beings suffer. And these five are called kleshas in Sanskrit, K-L-E-S-H-A-S. The first klesha, or the first cause of human suffering, is not knowing the true nature of reality. Number one, not knowing the true nature of reality. The second klesha, number two, is clinging to, or grasping, or holding on to that which is ephemeral, transitory, illusory, insubstantial, and therefore not real. Second cause of suffering. The third cause of suffering, the third klesha, is aversion to, revulsion to, fear from, or fear of, that which is insubstantial, transitory, ephemeral, not real, illusory. The fourth cause of suffering is identification with a false and constricted and habitual self, which we call the ego. And the fifth cause of suffering, the fifth klesha, is the fear of death. And Vedanta says, that's it. These are the five reasons why humans suffer. Not knowing the true nature of reality, grasping to things that aren't real, running away from and fearing things that are not real, identification with a false self, a constricted self, and the fear of death. Period. All other causes of suffering can be somehow connected to these five. And then Vedanta goes on to say that these five are contained in the first one. The five kleshas are contained in the first one. So the only cause of suffering is not knowing the true nature of reality. The only cause of suffering is not knowing the true nature of reality. Vedanta says the true nature of reality is Brahman. Brahman is a word like any other. And if you ask a Vedantist to describe it, he can't. He says he cannot describe what Brahman is except to call it that. That, the English word that. In Sanskrit, tat. And Vedanta says, I am that, you are that, all this is that, that's all there is. And if you really, really get that, then I have nothing more to say. Good night, thanks for coming. Vedanta refers to Brahman as that. It's infinite, it's immortal, it's eternal, it's ineffable, it's unbounded, it is silent, it has infinite dynamism, it has infinite intelligence, and it is it, whatever it is. And this Brahman projects itself as the universe through what is called the power of Maya. Brahman projects itself as the physical universe, including you and me, as through the power of Maya. The word Maya means, technically, etymologically, it means measurement. Although it's translated frequently as illusion, because what you're trying to measure is eternity, or the infinite. And in the measurement of the infinite, you create the concept of time, and you give birth to the relative universe. So Maya, measurement, meter, the English word meter, which also is something you use to measure. Maya, meter, measurement, time, music, matter, all refer to the womb of creation, which is the infinite, unbounded womb of creation, which projects itself through the power of Maya into the realm of space, time, and causation. And it does so through the web of karma. Karma is our own past actions on an individual level, but also on a collective level, and ultimately from a deeper, more mystical level. The remnants of karma are past actions. They are like seeds in our consciousness. And these remnants of karma constantly actualize into our consciousness as our subjective experience. They're just the seeds of past memories, past experiences. They're not the memories themselves. They are virtual memories, just like you have virtual photons and virtual particles. They're virtual memories that don't actually exist in the brain because they are part of the software of our souls. You know, I was watching the other day on 60 Minutes, the person who just wrote Mr. Reagan's biography. I don't know if you saw that program, but there's a very poignant moment in the program where he says that he's a family friend of Mr. Reagan, and apparently Mr. Reagan recently came from a therapy session, and somebody had left a toy White House next to the fish tank, and Mr. Reagan was clutching onto it, holding onto it when he came, and Nancy Reagan tried to pry his fingers open, and he wouldn't let go of it. And finally she said to him, "Ronnie, what's that in your hand?" And he looked at it for a minute or so and he said, "I don't know what it is, but I think it has something to do with me. I don't know what it is, but I think it has something to do with me. That's what a sanskara is. That's what a potential memory is. That's the remnant of karma. And I looked at that program and realized, you know, we all have Alzheimer's. All of us. We all have spiritual Alzheimer's.
I'm very relieved to hear that. Okay. I thought it was only me.
Yes. We have this memory. We have this faint memory that somewhere there is a soul over here. A faint memory that somewhere there is a soul here. We know it has something to do with me, and we have no idea what it is. And that's what Vedanta says is the cause of all our suffering. In fact, the Bible says that too. What good does it do a man to find the whole world but lose his own soul? And losing the soul, we begin to have the experience of suffering. So this karmic software, which is constantly actualizing into our consciousness, it appears as our own thoughts, our own memories, our desires, our feelings, our emotions. And during the daytime, what we do is our rational mind, it weaves stories around this karmic software. It does so quite logically, at least to the rational mind. And we live out these stories. We call them everyday reality. And the same thing happens at night, but the rational mind is asleep. And so there is not a consistent logic to the stories at night. We call them dreams. But Vedanta says the mechanics of the dream and the mechanics of waking state of consciousness is identically, it's the same. One is being given a rationalization and the other isn't. But it's just your karmic software that is appearing in your consciousness and that you're making stories out of them and you're living these stories out. And you get so caught up in the melodrama and the hysteria of the stories that you actually forget who you are. It's like going to a really good movie and getting lost in the movie. And therefore, the only way to come out of this tangled hierarchy, because it is a tangled hierarchy where we lose ourselves in the scenery. The seer loses itself in the scenery. The lover loses himself in the beloved. The knower loses himself or herself in the objects of knowledge, never remembering that there is a timeless factor in the midst of every time-bound experience. All experience is time-bound. It has a beginning, a middle, and an ending. But in the midst of all this, there's a timeless factor. It's the experiencer. And the experiencer is the I inside. Not just the personal I, but the collective I and the universal I. That if I start to peel the layers of my soul, I'll go beyond my constricted fabrication, the constricted self-identity that I have, and I'll discover who I really am. And this is the essence of Vedanta. And Vedanta says there are four ways to do it. It's as simple as that. The first is called Karma Yoga, which is to be always reminding yourself that no matter what you're doing, you're not doing it. It's God. God does everything. There is only God. And this is the machinery through which that divine intelligence is working. So the essence of Karma Yoga is to be established in being and perform action. Yogast Kuru Karmani, as Lord Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita. The second way to find the truth, to find the nature of reality, is through love, the experience of love, which is Bhakti Yoga or devotion. And it's the simplest and most enjoyable, but it gets you to the same place. So that's the second means to find the truth. Because love is the ultimate reality, and love is not a mere emotion, love is not a mere sentiment, it's the ultimate truth at the heart of creation. And the ultimate truth at the heart of creation is that we are all the same being under different disguises, in different disguises. When we feel that, then it becomes impossible to hurt or be hurt. What the Buddha refers to as compassion is really also the experiential knowledge of love as the ultimate truth at the heart of creation. The third means is Raja Yoga, which is meditation and its allied disciplines. All the different types of ways to dive into the gap between our thoughts, to go beyond the secret passages and the dark alleys of our minds and find this part of ourselves that does not die. And that is the discipline of Raja Yoga, the meditation and its allied principles or techniques. And the fourth means is what is called Jnana Yoga. Unfortunately, I've lost myself in that for my entire life. Jnana Yoga is the intellectual approach, which is also called the razor's edge, because you're using the intellect to go beyond the intellect. And that in itself seems to be a paradox, but it's possible to use the intellect and go beyond the intellect, ultimately, to go beyond the rational mind. And that essentially is all of Vedanta, all the 112 Upanishads, somehow or the other, talk around these few principles. If one has gotten close to the event horizon, which is called enlightenment in both the Vedantic tradition and the Buddhist tradition, then that experiential knowledge of immortality solves all suffering, because you find out who you really are. As the Sufi poet Rumi has said in one of his most elegant poems, he says, "By God, when you see your beauty, you'll be the idol of yourself." I've just done a new translation of Tagore's poems, and I chose his poems on the phenomenon and the experience of death, because I've always wondered, what would it be like to be in that place in your consciousness where you have lost all fear and can embrace death as lovingly and as in as much a celebratory mood as you can approach life. Only you can only do it if you have come home. And so what I'd like to do before I end is read to you about three or four of these contemporary translations that I have just done from Tagore. And I'll wear my fancy glasses to do that. But you can see what it must be to be in that place. These poems were written by the Indian poet Tagore, who won the Nobel Prize in 1913. A Bengali poet who was not just a poet, he was a real rishi, he was a real seer, and he had really understood Vedanta. And towards the end of his life, when he was approaching his so-called death, this is what he wrote, and I'd like to read you just for a minute or two what he said. He said, "I know that the day will come when my sight of this earth shall be lost, and life will take its leave in silence, drawing the last curtain over my eyes. Yet stars will watch at night, and morning rise as before, and hours heave like sea waves, casting up pleasures and pains. When I think of this end of my moments, the barrier of the moments breaks, and I see by the light of death your world with its careless treasures. Rare is its lowliest seat, rare is its meanest of lives. Things that I longed for in vain, and things that I got, let them pass. Let me but truly possess the things that I ever spurned and overlooked." You know, other people have said that if you were aware that death is stalking you right now, I look behind myself and the Prince of Death is stalking me. And in fact, if I look back again, it's closer. If I was aware that death is stalking me in every moment of my life would be magical, because I would change my priorities, as he says. Things that I longed for and things that I got, let them pass. Let me but truly possess the things that I ever spurned and overlooked. Here again, he says, and look at the splendor and magnificence of his mood as he approaches his final moments. At this time of my parting, wish me good luck, my friends. The sky is flushed with the dawn, and my path lies beautiful. Ask not what I have with me to take there. I start on my journey with empty hands and an expectant heart. I shall put on my wedding garland. Mine is not the red-brown dress of the traveler, and though there are dangers on the way, I have no fear in my mind. The evening star will come out when my voyage is done, and the plaintive notes of the twilight melodies will be struck up from the king's highway. And one or two more. I was not aware of the moment when I first crossed the threshold of this life. What was the power that made me open out into this vast mystery like a bud in the forest at midnight? When in the morning I looked upon the light, I felt in a moment that I was no stranger in this world, that the inscrutable, without name and form, had taken me in its arms in the form of my own mother. Even so in death, same unknown will appear as ever known to me, and because I love this life, I know I shall love death as well. The child cries out when from the right breast the mother takes it away, in the very next moment to find in the left one its consolation. And the final one. When I go from hence, let this be my parting word, that what I have seen is unsurpassable. I have tasted of the hidden honey of this lotus that expands on the ocean of life and light. And so I am blessed. Let this be my parting word. In this playhouse of infinite forms, I have had my play, and here I have caught sight of him that is formless. My whole body and my whole limbs have thrilled with his touch, who is beyond touch. And if the end comes here, let it come. Let this be my parting word. Thank you very much.
Thank you.